Cale Clark here. Thanks for listening to my podcast. Check out Charity Mobile and prayerfully consider making them your wireless carrier. Mention offer code Relevant Radio and get a free phone. Don't delay. CharityMobile.com. That's CharityMobile.com.
Fascinating facts, candid conversations, and some levity to lighten your day. This is the Cale Clark Show on Relevant Radio.
Welcome to the show. A marvelous Monday to you. You can call me right now, 888-914-9149. We're going to start your week off right. 888-914-9149. Whether you're listening in LA or all the way across the country in Maine or anywhere in the world, call in right now, 888-914-9149. You can also email the program, Cale, C-A-L-E, at relevantradio.com. And you can, as always, follow me on Twitter, at Cale Clark. C-A-L-E, Clark with an E. And the show account is at Cale Clark Show. So lots to get to today on this Monday as we kick off the work week. Got a little reflection for you on the surprising connection between work and worship that's coming up later. Also, how you're getting scammed, how you're getting ripped off, in most cases without even knowing it. I'm going to tell you about that later, too. And you can call in once again with your questions, your comments, 888-914-9149. Well, as the war in Ukraine rages on and some of the latest troubling news, there's so much that's troubling with this, but Putin is now being accused of mass abductions of Ukrainian citizens. The city of Mariupol, which is refusing to surrender to Russia, a lot of media is reporting, and this is really kind of a chilling echo of the Second World War, that Kremlin troops are forcibly deporting thousands of people from Mariupol, allegedly to cities deep inside of Russia. So in light of all this, and obviously the courage of many Russians who are standing up to this unjust war, I wonder if you've heard the story of Russia's Tiananmen teen. Now, you say, hold on here, Tiananmen? Isn't that Tiananmen Square? That's a different country, right? Well, yes, yes, of course, we remember the guy who became known as Tank Man. No idea what his real name is, but we all know him, that iconic image from Beijing in 1989, that brave soul who stood in the path of a tank that year. Well, Russia has Olga Misik, and she is called the Tiananmen teen of Russia. And she became very well known back in 2019. A photo of her went viral. On her lap was a copy of the Russian Constitution. And she was seated on the ground, on the pavement, and there was a huge squad of Russian riot police decked out in full gear encircling her. There was a demonstration going on at the time that was calling for transparent elections in Moscow. A lot of people were injured in this conflict with riot police. But this photo of Olga Misik, who at the time was 17 years old, went viral, and she became a symbol of the pro-democracy movement in Russia. And a lot of people compared this photo to that image from Tiananmen Square in 1989. If you want to see this image, you can actually go to my Twitter feed. I posted a picture of this at Cale Clark, C-A-L-E, Clark with an E on Twitter. You can follow me there. So at the time, Olga was 17 years old, and Moscow was seeing a lot of protests that were happening. A lot of candidates who were running in elections for the city assembly, Duma, they were being disqualified, and they were very, very fishy circumstances. All the authorities who were, of course, loyal to Russian President Putin, they were saying, well, these opposition candidates, they don't have enough signatures. They haven't collected enough signatures to run for office. So they're disqualified. And of course, people who really knew what was going on had their doubts about that. And Olga, who is now attending Moscow State University, she's about 20 years old now. She's studying journalism. She said at the time that when she protested, when this photo of her went viral, it wasn't just about these particular elections. She was highlighting something that had been going on in Russia for some time, a gradual drifting away from the Russian Constitution, which was instituted after the Soviet Union broke apart. And that Constitution is supposed to value the rights of Russian people. And a lot of ink was spilled about this. And I read a piece about this on the BBC World Service. It was written by Megha Mohan and Nina Nazarova, all about Olga and the surrounding situation. And Olga was quoted at the time saying, "Hey, I don't support any particular political party. I'm only for myself and the people." Now, she was born and grew up in a suburb of Moscow, and she was the middle child in her family. She loved to read, and she especially liked the works of George Orwell, Aldous Huxley, and obviously they talked about in their books dystopian futures, and sadly, a lot of these things seem to be happening right now, authoritarian regimes. She was great at school, straight-A student, loved current affairs, but she really didn't get interested in politics, Olga Misyk, until 2018. And again, she was only 16 years old at the time. She started watching protests on social media. And what was going on then was that Vladimir Putin wanted to raise the retirement age in Russia. He was trying to raise the retirement age to age 60 for women. It used to be 55. And he was raising it to age 65 for men. It used to be 60. Now, some of you might say, well, that sounds pretty great to me. But this was a major change in the law in Russia. And Olga Misyk saw an injustice in this. She said, quote, "It's not like I'm near retirement myself." She was only 16 at the time. "But I saw the injustice. I was angry with the politicians because President Putin himself promised that he wouldn't increase the retirement age. And then he went ahead and signed it into law in October of 2018. Eventually, her involvement in social issues led to her taking a stand when that famous photograph was taken. It was on the 27th of July in 2019. And there were, again, thousands of people that were attending a protest that was considered illegal. It was considered unauthorized. And it was against the ban on any opposition activists running in the elections. A lot of the opposition leaders were actually detained before this rally even started. And that's where she was sitting cross-legged in front of the riot police. They had their shields, batons, and helmets on. And she pulled out her copy of the 1993 Russia Constitution, and she began reading from it. And she read four sections. She said that she read Article 31, which talks about the right to peacefully protest, says that everybody can take part in elections, everybody has freedom of speech, and that the people's will and the people's power are the most important thing for the country. Well, that's what she was reading to the to these riot police and showing them the text. Here's where it says this. And she would people were snapping the photo. Obviously, one of those photos went viral. And she was allowed to walk away from this demonstration, but only for a time. On her way home, she was later arrested in a subway station. In fact, more than 1,000 protesters were arrested that day. And she says that she wasn't necessarily mistreated by the police, but she was feeling ill, wanted to see a doctor. They wouldn't let her. And she was eventually released 12 hours later and fined 20,000 rubles, which would be about $305 American, for taking part in an illegal protest. And she says, you know, she was quoted as saying by the BBC that not many young women in Russia are politically motivated, but really only those who want to go into journalism. She's kind of the exception. And so she's still at it. She's still at it. Obviously, with the war in Ukraine, she's protesting that. And there was a news piece that I saw on the Daily Beast that a lot of Russian activists, including Olga, were in fact targeted after the very public speech that Vladimir Putin made very recently, calling for, quote, a self-cleansing of society from what he called scum and traitors. And in fact, Olga Misyk, her apartment door was vandalized. There was a message that was painted on it, along with that now infamous letter Z that has been painted on Russian tanks and military vehicles. Gosh, I guess you could call it World War Z, to paraphrase that Brad Pitt film. I almost said Bad Pitt film. It might be a bad film. I've never seen it, but World War Z, that phrase has come up a lot in reference to this. But a lot of journalists, activists, like Olga Misyk, also Dmitry Ivanov, received these messages spray-painted on their door featuring that symbol. And so Olga Misyk had a good sense of humor about it. She posted, and you can follow her on Twitter, actually, at Thorkiman, T-H-O-R-K-I-M-A-N. M-I-N at Thorkamen or Thorkamen. I don't know how she pronounces it. But anyways, her message was in Cyrillic on Twitter, but it was translated as, "My apartment has undergone cosmetic procedures." And what they had basically painted on her front door was, "Don't betray your country." And then there was an expletive, which I'm not going to repeat here, directed to her. And so obviously that speech happened on Wednesday by Putin. He was cheering on what he called the self-cleansing of society. Obviously, many prominent Russians have left the country. Others have been detained. Others have been charged, including a very brave television producer for protesting the unjust war in Ukraine. And so Putin is really kind of taking aim at everybody who wants to stop the war, everybody from the international community, everybody in Russia who agrees with that. He's bashing people who have ties to the West. He's accusing them of cozying up to the United States to feel like they belong to what he calls a quote-unquote higher caste. And here's what Putin said, quote, "Russian people will be able to distinguish true patriots from scum and traitors and simply spit them out like a fly that accidentally flew into their mouths," end of quote. So he thinks this is a what he calls a self-purification of Russia. So we really need to pray for these brave activists who are there. And obviously, if enough of them get out there, if hundreds of thousands of people take to the streets, they can't all be arrested. They can't all be threatened with 15 years in prison. So they really do need our support. So that was something that really caught my eye, the story of Olga Misyk, who some years ago, just a couple of years ago in 2019, was called Russia's Tiananmen teen. And she and many others are still protesting the injustice that's going on right now. You're listening to The Cale Clark Show on Relevant Radio. If you want to react to that, you can call me right now, 888-914-9149, and we'll be right back after this short break. Catholic Order of Foresters is proud to sponsor the Relevant Radio studio line. For information about employment opportunities and flexible premium life insurance plans, visit relevantradio.com/Forester.
Explaining the Catholic faith and how you can live it and share it too. It's the Cale Clark Show. Have a question? Give Cale a call at 888-914-9149.
Hey, welcome back to the show. Yeah, you just heard that number. I'll repeat it once again, 888-914-9149. Call toll-free to talk to me. Well, it's Monday. We're kicking off a brand new work week for most of us. And I just thought it was really fascinating in light of this past weekend because, of course, on Saturday we celebrated the Solemnity of St. Joseph. So, hey, we can put aside our Lenten penances for a day and just really enjoy that day. St. Joseph is obviously so important to us here at Relevant Radio, so important to all of us. But also on Sunday, it was really interesting that the gospel, and of course the gospel on Sunday was from, of course, John's gospel, that famous encounter between Jesus and the woman at the well. And really, believe it or not, those two things, St. Joseph and that encounter that Jesus had, really come together when we're thinking about work and worship, the surprising connections, really, between work and worship. Now, we know that in St. Joseph's case, coming up in May, on May 1st, there's actually a whole feast day dedicated to him under this title. St. Joseph obviously was known as the carpenter. He worked, but that Greek word in the Gospels that's translated as carpenter, it's actually something a little bit more than that. There's an underlying Greek word there, and the word is tekton, tekton. And those of you who listen to our sister program, the Faith Explained, which I also host here on Relevant Radio, I've talked about that a couple of times, that tekton actually can cover a very wide range of work activities, everything from designing to working with all kinds of materials, not just wood, maybe even stone. And you might really say that Joseph could have been something like a modern-day architect or even an engineer, so much more than a carpenter. Now, we know that, of course, he was never quoted as saying anything directly in the Bible. He's really that silent knight That silent night with a K, and a holy night with a K. But that holiness spoke really loud and clear. Even though he didn't have anything to say, his work spoke volumes. Now, this theology of work, that's something we don't really talk about enough in the church, because a lot of people, and I would say even a lot of Catholics, are under an impression that work is some kind of a punishment for sin. But you and I know better than that, or at least we should know better than that. In the book of Genesis, the very first book in the Bible, and by the way, I did a whole series explaining the book of Genesis, and you can find that on relevantradio.com. If you go to our shows and look at the Faith Explained, all of the Genesis episodes are there for you, along with Revelation and many of the other series that we've done. Currently, right now, going through a series on the Our Fathers. You can listen to it live at 12:30 Central, or you can check the archives, check the podcast. But one of the things I noted in the Genesis series is that if you read that book really closely, work existed in the world before sin was in the world. So work is not a punishment for sin. Work is, in fact, a really good gift of God, and it's part of human flourishing. We need that. If you go back to Adam, the first man, what was his job? He had one. God gave him a job, and his job was essentially to till and to keep. Now, in our English Bibles, it says that, to till and to keep the Garden of Eden. You can read that, by the way, if you want to look it up, Genesis chapter 2, verse 15. Now, the underlying Hebrew, you know Genesis was written in Hebrew, of course. The underlying Hebrew words for to till and to keep, that's really interesting, because those are the same words that are used of the service of the priests in the temple, in the tabernacle. Wow. And so the tabernacle is kind of the mobile version of the temple in the wilderness for the Israelites. And so that's something that should really jump out to us, because if that was the work of the priests, that should say something about our own work. One of the truths that we've got to recover is that any type of work, any type of job, no matter what it is, as long as it's an honest job, can be sanctified. That work can be sanctified. You can make it holy. You can make your work holy, and you can make yourself holy through your work. God can make you holy through your work. That's probably a better way to say it. And you can help make other people holy through that as well. That's really the arena in many ways that we encounter God. That's where we spend a good portion of our waking hours, is at work. And we need to be able to encounter God there too. So I really think that we have to do away with the expression a secular job. Okay, well, priests, of course, they're ministerial priests. They offer the sacraments. They help to sanctify the people of God. But really, any job, and that's true of more than just, you know, religious life, any honest job can be a way to encounter God. So we've got to go away from the expression secular job or secular vocation. Any job, as long as it's honest, we can find God there and really become holy ourselves and help other people too as well. So what's also interesting about the book of Genesis, when we look at what's there, what we find in the garden that Adam was supposed to be looking after, well, it talks about some things that are found there, some items that are in the Garden of Eden. Gold, talks about gold, talks about onyx. We've heard about onyx. Maybe some of you guys have an onyx countertop or something, or some onyx jewelry. But there's also something called the bdellium that was found in the Garden of Eden as well. Now, most people have never heard of the bdellium, but actually all three of those things, gold, onyx, bdellium, are found on the garments of the high priest. And they're also found in all the furnishings of the temple and in the tabernacle as well, before the temple was built. Onyx, bdellium were found on the vestments of the high priest. And so when you add it all up, the verbs, you know, to till and to keep, that was kind of Adam's job, gold, onyx, bdellium, it's pretty clear that the book of Genesis is telling us, it's almost screaming in our ears, that Adam, in the Garden of Eden, he was really being presented as a priest king over all of creation. That's part of his work. And when you think about our baptism, our Catholic baptism, we share in that threefold office of Christ as prophet, priest, and king by virtue of our baptism. So that's really fascinating. And in the Old Testament, only the Levites, only the tribe of Levi eventually had the priestly functions in ancient Israel. The tribe of Levi was given that charge. And actually, before that happened, every Israelite male was, as sort of the head of the household, considered to be a priest. And before that, Adam himself, the first man, was priest-king over all creation. So obviously, after the golden calf incident in the wilderness, that's when the priesthood was passed on specifically to that tribe of Levi. But all, you know, firstborn Israelite males, going back to Adam himself, had that sort of priest-king option. So what do priests actually do? Well, priests actually do three things when you boil it down. They sanctify people. They help to sanctify people, make them holy. They make offerings to God. That's what they did in the Old Testament. Priests still do it today. And they also help to bring other people to God. And that's one of the great titles of the Pope, by the way. And every Pope loves to use this title, Pontifex. You probably heard that title used of the Holy Father. Well, don't forget what that word means. The word Pontifex actually means bridge builder. So he tries to build a bridge, just like every priest does, from humanity to God. And that's really what Jesus did as our great high priest as well. He built that bridge, if you will, called the cross. And that brings people to God. The cross is that bridge that we can cross over to get to heaven. It's a beautiful image. And so that's one thing we've got to keep in mind when we think about how to look at your work the right way, the way that St. Joseph would have, St. Joseph the worker. There's another image as well, though, and I talked about this as well in the Genesis series. It's this image of the sacred compass. And this is where this conversation with the woman at the well really comes in. This takes us back to God's original plan for humanity. So what's the sacred compass? Well, imagine in your mind's eye, I want you to think about a bullseye, right? Like a dartboard or something like that. So a series of concentric circles expanding ever outward from the center, all right? Just like you might throw a stone in the lake, you know, if you're camping in the summertime, you see those circles rippling out in the water, wider and wider, greater and greater, ever outward. So that's the kind of image I want you to put in your mind. So that little circle in the middle, right? If you think about the middle of the bullseye, that is what I want you to think of as the most holy place. So let's go back to the Garden of Eden. Did you know that when the Israelites built the tabernacle, the mobile temple, when they eventually built the permanent temple in Jerusalem, they actually constructed it using the Garden of Eden as a model? That's why they built it the way it was built, because this is God's original intent for worship. So what they wanted to do, basically, was take this with them on their journey towards the Promised Land through the wilderness. They essentially wanted the Garden of Eden, as it were, to go with them on their journey. And eventually we all want to get to the ultimate Garden of Eden, the new heavens, the new earth. That's going to be exciting. I don't know exactly what that's going to be like, but that's really what the purpose was of the tabernacle, of eventually the temple. They wanted it to be constructed like the Garden of Eden. Well, in the middle of the Garden of Eden, what was there? Or who was there? It's probably a better way to put it. The very presence of God. And that's why at the heart of the temple and the tabernacle was the most holy place. Think about the Ark of the Covenant. You've probably all seen the movie Raiders of the Lost Ark, and if you haven't, shame on you. But think about the Ark of the Covenant with the golden wings of the cherubim, those carved angels stretching out over the top of the Ark. That was called the mercy seat. The very presence of God was over top of the Ark, the mercy seat. That was in the most holy place. So that's kind of the middle of the bullseye. This is the sacred compass. Now, if you step out just one circle beyond that, what's right around the most holy place? That's called the antechamber. The antechamber. So that would be the quote-unquote garden part of the Garden of Eden. And that's why, by the way, if you read about the tabernacle, that's why they filled it with garden imagery, because they wanted it, again, to be like the Garden of Eden. So that's why they made it with things like the menorah, the seven-branch candelabra. You might have heard of the menorah. You've certainly seen it. In Rome, there's the famous Arch of Titus that really immortalized in stone the looting of the temple by the Romans in 70 AD when it was destroyed. And you see them carrying away the menorah. Well, why was the menorah built that way? The menorah was supposed to represent the tree of life. That's why it looks like that. So anyway, so that's the antechamber. Now let's move outwards one more step in this sacred compass, if you will. That's called the courtyard area. So you see, we're moving out from the center, we're moving ever outwards. So the next step is the courtyard. Now people were only allowed in the courtyard when they were making sacrifices, when they were bringing sacrifices to God. Now think about that. How many sacrifices happened at that level of the tabernacle, surrounding the most holy place? How many sacrifices happen in the temple? There are some ancient writers that say at Passover time, there were millions of lambs that were slaughtered. You know, it seems like an exaggeration, but it might actually be right on because of so many pilgrims that traveled there for the feast. So think about all the sacrifices that happened surrounding the most holy place in the temple in Jerusalem. All right, let's step out one more step outwards, the next circle. Let's go outwards one more. That's called the camp. Now that's when the Israelites were traveling, that was the general place where they camped out. That's where they did their living. That's where they pitched their tents. They're moving along on their wilderness journey with the tabernacle. All right, so what's outside the camp? Let's go out one more circle in the sacred compass that kind of emanates out from the bullseye, from the most holy place. What's outside of the camp? Well, what's outside the camp is basically everything else. Everything, everyone, all the other groups that were out there, all the other people groups that were out there. So the concept is the further you get away from the center, the further you get away from the most holy place, the further you get away from the very presence of God, guess what? The further you're going to get away from holiness itself. So that was the idea. That was the concept. That's the sacred compass. And it was all modeled after the Garden of Eden. That's why it's really important that you understand this. And this is why when Jesus dies on the cross, we're going to talk about this on Good Friday, the moment that Jesus died on the cross, something very interesting happened. The letter to the Hebrews puts it this way. Where did he die? He died outside the camp. Outside the camp, outside of the holy city. And then you look at Mark chapter 15, verse 38, and it says that at the moment Jesus dies and gives up his spirit, the curtain of the temple is torn in two from top to bottom. Now, that's the very curtain, by the way, that separated the most holy place in the temple, the center of the bullseye, from everywhere else. So look at Mark chapter 15. It says, when the sixth hour had come, there was darkness over the whole land until the ninth hour. And at the ninth hour, Jesus cried with a loud voice, Eloi, Eloi, lema sabachthani, which means, my God, why have you forsaken me? And some of the bystanders hearing it said, behold, he is calling Elijah. And one ran and filling a sponge full of vinegar, put it on a reed and gave it to him to drink, saying, wait, let us see whether Elijah will come to take him down. And Jesus uttered a loud cry and breathed his last. That shout, that was really the shout of death. That was the powerful release of his spirit. And then what happens? The curtain of the temple was torn in two from top to bottom. And when the centurion who stood facing him saw that he thus breathed his last, he said, truly, this man was the Son of God. And that's important too, because Caesar, the Roman emperor, was declared to be a living Son of God. So this guy is basically saying, my boss is not the Son of God. This guy is the real Son of God. He deserves my allegiance. So, okay, when that temple was torn in two from top to bottom, it means, number one, God did it. This curtain was huge. I mean, it was so tall that nobody could reach the top of it standing on the ground. You literally needed a ladder. But it's torn in two from top to bottom. That means only God could have done such a thing. But here's what it also means. That was the curtain separating off the most holy place. That means now the very presence of God is on the loose in the world. The curtain has been torn. Guess what? Now God can be found anywhere and everywhere. So it's no longer the case that the further you get away from the temple, the further you're away from God's holy presence. No, now you can encounter God anywhere in the world. And that's really what brings us to this past Sunday's gospel, that conversation that Jesus had with the woman at the well in John chapter 4. And I'm not going to read the whole gospel to you. You can definitely check that on your own time. It's well worth reading, of course. But one of the things that happens in the context of that conversation is that Jesus says to the woman, "Go call your husband and come back." And the woman says, "Oh, I have no husband." And then Jesus says to her, "Oh, you're right in saying that you have no husband, for you've had five husbands. And the one you have now is not your husband." In other words, you've been married five times, divorced five times, and now you're living with a man that's not your husband. Yep, you're right. You have no husband. Now, little does she know that the person that she's talking to, the Jesus that she's talking to, he is the divine bridegroom. The church is his bride. Jesus is the new Adam, the much greater Adam. And this woman, this poor woman, has been so unfortunate in romantic relationships, so unfortunate and unlucky in love. But the divine bridegroom, who's really the lover of her soul, is now there. So there's a little bit more marriage imagery from the Garden of Eden as well. So then she's trying to kind of change the subject. She's getting a little bit uncomfortable, and she says, "Sir, I perceive that you're a prophet. Okay, you've told me some stuff about me that you would have no way of knowing unless you had divine insight." So I think she's trying to change the subject. But she starts talking about how, well, our fathers worshipped on this mountain, and yet you say that in Jerusalem, that's the right place where people ought to worship. And this is when Jesus says to her, "Woman, believe me, the hour is coming when neither on this mountain nor in Jerusalem will you worship the Father. You worship what you do not know." Now, she was a Samaritan. "You worship what you do not know, but we worship what we know, for salvation is from the Jews." So this is very interesting, because Jesus says, basically, you're wrong. So if anybody ever tries to tell you, Jesus would never tell anyone they're wrong about religion. No. He would, and he did. He said, "Listen, you guys don't know what you're talking about. Let me enlighten you a little bit. Salvation is from the Jews." But listen to this. Jesus says the hour is coming, and now is, when the true worshipers will worship the Father in spirit and in truth. For such the Father seeks to worship him. God is spirit, and those who worship him must worship in spirit and in truth. And the woman says, "I know that the Messiah is coming, he who is called Christ. When he comes, he will show us all things." And Jesus said to her, "I who speak to you am he." So Jesus goes, you know, in her eyes, from just a guy who's thirsty, who wants a drink, to, oh, maybe he's a prophet, maybe he's the Messiah. No, he actually is the Messiah. Wow, okay. I'm not even going to get into the fact that they're sitting at the well, and it was actually thought that streams of living water, Jesus says, "I'm going to promise you living water." It was thought that streams of living water would also pour out of the temple in Jerusalem. So we see this in the book of Ezekiel. And of course, when Jesus is crucified, when he dies on the cross, his heart is pierced, and out of that heart comes streams of living water, blood and water. Okay, we've got the Holy Spirit here. But here's the point of it. Jesus says it doesn't matter whether you're on this mountain, in Jerusalem, it doesn't matter where you are in the world, God is everywhere and can be worshipped everywhere. No matter what you're doing, no matter where you are, you can encounter him in your life, in your work. And that means that God is where you work. You can encounter him there too. You can sanctify your work. And so this is what it's all about: sanctifying your work, sanctifying yourself in your work, and sanctifying others through your work. And that's what St. Jose Maria Escrivá, the founder of Opus Dei, used to talk about all the time. A big part of this is realizing that God is there in the first place, along with you. So the place of sacrifice, it's no longer the altar in the temple in Jerusalem. It's wherever you happen to be. Your desk can be an altar, right? St. Paul talks about this in Romans chapter 12, verses 1 and 2. He says, "I appeal to you, therefore, by the mercies of God, to present your bodies as a living sacrifice, holy and acceptable to God, which is your spiritual worship." So this idea that you can offer your very self, that's the true offering, that's a true sacrifice. And he says that's true spirituality. Offering your bodies as a living sacrifice, holy and acceptable, that is your spiritual worship. There's so many people out there who say, "I'm not religious, I'm spiritual. I don't need organized religion. I don't need the Catholic Church. I'm just naturally a spiritual person." Nonsense. St. Paul says, look, spirituality is offering yourself as a living sacrifice. Wow. So obviously we know the problem of the living sacrifice. It can always crawl off the altar and run away, right? We've got free will. we have to choose to do it. We have to unite our will with God's will. We've got to lay down our lives for Christ. So this is really profound when it comes to thinking about our work as we start off this new work week. Whatever we do in life, it all can be made holy. It can be made a spiritual sacrifice. And that's what Jesus did, right? And he did that from the beginning. When St. Joseph was working with him in the workshop under the gaze of Our Lady, they did it. They did it. And Jesus was, in a sense, you know, he was redeeming the world even then. He was redeeming ordinary work, ordinary family life. And one of the things that St. Jose Maria said was that if we don't find God in the ordinary things of every day, we're never going to find him at all. So Joseph, when he was in that workshop, he literally encountered God in his work. The Son of God, Jesus, who was also his son. And you and I can do the exact same thing. We can encounter God in our work. So I just thought it was really interesting, the gospel passage coupled with that Feast of St. Joseph on Saturday. So I just wanted to share that with you as we kind of a little fervorino here as we start the work week together. You're listening to the Cale Clark Show on Relevant Radio. 1-888-914-9149 is the number to call. I'll be right back after this short break. Catholic Order of Foresters is proud to sponsor the Relevant Radio studio line. For information about employment opportunities and flexible premium life insurance plans, visit relevantradio.com/Forester.
Explaining the faith so you can explain it to others. It's the Cale Clark Show on Relevant Radio and the Relevant Radio app.
Hey, welcome back to the program. 1-888-914-9149 is the number to call. You can also follow me on Twitter at Cale Clark, C-A-L-E, Clark with an E. We're going to go to the phones right now. Lauren is calling from Oregon. Hi, Lauren. Welcome to the show.
Well, hi, Cale. So I just wanted to comment and also question with regard to, I was listening to the talk about the consecration of Russia, and it's my understanding from reading a lot about what several priests all over have been saying, and many theologians have been saying, is that, and this has been known even over the years, that Pope John Paul II consecrated the world, but did not do as our Blessed Mothers had requested, which was to consecrate specifically Russia. And so Pope Francis now is planning to consecrate Russia. And I, like the other caller, do not understand why he didn't ask for everybody or request that all the bishops go ahead and join him, although I know that many are. But it's unfortunate that it wasn't done earlier, because now there are so many more bishops that would have to join in.
So let me ask you, Lauren. So you're wondering whether whether or not the consecration that was done by Pope John Paul II was legitimate?
Well, it was legitimate for the whole world, but our Blessed Mother had specifically asked for Russia, and now our Blessed Mother and Jesus are both talking to the seers, many of the seers, as you probably know, and saying that it's imperative that Russia be consecrated. And if it was consecrated, they wouldn't be saying that now.
Let me jump in there for a second there, Lauren. Okay, I'm not sure about these seers and whether or not they're really hearing from God. Maybe they are. We're going to let the bishops of the church adjudicate that. But with respect to your question on whether or not St. John Paul II did the consecration properly as Our Lady of Fatima had requested, the answer is yes, he did do it right. He did do it right. And there are even people today who are saying that that Pope Francis, by consecrating Russia and Ukraine, he's not doing it right either, because he's throwing Ukraine in there. Well, this is really nonsense. First of all, let me tell you what Our Lady of Fatima said. One of the things that she said was this: when you see a night illumined by an unknown light, know that this is the great sign given you by God that he is about to punish the world for its crimes by means of war, famine, and persecutions of the Church and of the Holy Father. To prevent this, I shall come to ask for the consecration of Russia to my Immaculate Heart and the Communion of Reparation on the first Saturdays. Now, in terms of this night illumined by an unknown light, we do know from newspaper reports that a really spectacular aurora borealis, it's the northern lights, a really spectacular instance of this occurred actually just before the outbreak of World War II. Now, obviously, one of the things that Our Lady talked about as well is that Russia will spread her errors throughout the world. Well, what would those errors be? Well, at the time, obviously, that was a reference to communism, not what's going on now. I'm not saying that what's going on now, I think it's a great idea that Pope Francis is doing the consecration again. But just understand that when St. John Paul II did consecrate the world to the Immaculate Heart of Mary, that did count for what she asked for Russia. How do we know this? How do we know this? Well, it's very simple. Sister Lucia herself, and I've talked about this on the program before. In fact, we did a whole show on this. I'm going to ask producer Jim to put a link to this in the show notes. We did an entire show on this. The Sister Lucia herself, who passed away a few years ago, she was one of the three shepherd children, one of the three seers of Fatima. She personally wrote a letter to St. John Paul II on November the 8th, 1989, and she confirmed that JP II did the consecration rite when he did it on the 25th of March in 1984. It satisfied Our Lady's wishes. That's what she said. And by the way, just a sidebar, it's well known that Sister Lucia continued to have supernatural visions of Our Lady long after Fatima. Okay, but that's kind of a side issue. Sister Lucia herself said that it worked. Okay, so I don't see how anybody else has any leg to stand on saying, oh, no, it didn't. Well, unless you're how do you know? Do you know better than her? She's one of the visionaries. I'm sorry, I'm going to take her word for it. I'm going to take her word for it. And by the way, many others did a consecration as well. Bishops inside Russia did the consecration as well during the Cold War period, during communism. At any rate, we went through all of this. I would refer you, if anybody wants to read some more about this, by the way, you could check out a book called The Last Secret of Fatima. And the foreword was written by Pope Benedict XVI. You can check that out. That was published by Doubleday. It came out a few years ago. Lots more information about that in that book. So we're going to go back to the phones right now. Paul is calling from Youngstown, Ohio. Hello, Paul. Welcome back once again. Paul, are you there? Are you still there? Paul is no longer with us. Okay. Or is he back? Is Paul back? Okay, maybe he's not. Okay, all right. So, Paul, you're welcome to call back if you can. We only have a few minutes left on the program. All right, so one of the things that I want to highlight to you over the next couple of minutes here is the fact that a lot of you guys, including me, we're all sort of in this boat, we're actually getting ripped off on a daily basis. Most of the time, we don't even notice it. It's a little phenomenon, I do mean little, known as shrinkflation. I don't know if you've heard of this, but you know what shrinkflation is? Well, it's basically when a product is downsized while keeping its price the same. Now, why do companies do this? Well, in today's environment, in recent figures that just came out, that you probably read this, no doubt, that prices increased 7.9%. That's basically 8% in the last year, in the last 12 months. That's inflation. So there's really a couple ways that companies try to deal with this. They can either raise the prices of their products in order to reflect the fact that a lot of the underlying materials cost more for them to produce. Or another thing that they try to do is they try to, sometimes on the sly, they try to take advantage of the situation by reducing the amount of product that they sell you while still keeping prices the same. And there's a great piece about this written by Clarissa Diaz on Quartz, on the website Quartz. And it kind of went through some situations where a lot of shoppers who are normally price sensitive, they might not notice subtle changes in packaging or read the fine print on the size or the weight of a product. So you're less likely to notice sometimes if you're getting less and because the price is the same, and you don't necessarily think about it. So companies normally want to keep you happy as a consumer, but they also want to keep their prices competitive with everybody else who's selling similar products. And so here's some examples of shrinkflation that have taken place just over the past year. Bounty triples, paper towels, right? Bounty, I think the tagline is the quicker picker-upper. Well, the prior version of Bounty triples, you know, the triple pack of paper towels, it'd be 165 sheets. The new version is 147 sheets. So what's the difference? Well, that basically amounts to 3 fewer sheets per roll or 18 fewer messes that you can clean up. What about Doritos? Well, the old version of bags of Doritos were 9.75 ounces. Well, the new version, which, by the way, is the same price, is 9.25 ounces. And that basically amounts to 5 fewer of those famous triangular chips. Family size packaging. Oh, man, this gets hit a lot. Wheat Thins, family size original. It used to be 16 ounces for the box. Now it's 14 ounces. That's 28 fewer crackers, okay? So it's a lot of snacking that's not getting done for the same price. And by the way, to their credit, the article did reach out to Frito-Lay, who obviously makes Doritos. To their credit, Frito-Lay actually admitted this practice of shrinkflation. They actually confirmed that they did shrink their bags because of pandemic pressures. And they said, quote, "Inflation is hitting everyone. We just took a little bit out of the bag so we can give you the same price and you can keep enjoying your chips," end of quote. All right, well, at least they fessed up to it. Confession time, at least they did that. Not the case with some other companies. PepsiCo, which makes Gatorade. Okay, Gatorade, the sports drink, obviously, recently replaced its 32-ounce size with a 28-ounce bottle for the exact same price. That's a 14% price increase, all right? So when they were asked for comment, here's what they said, quote, "We redesigned the bottle. It's more aerodynamic, and it's easier to grab. The redesign generates a new cost, and the bottles are a little bit more expensive. This is only a matter of design," end of quote. Really? Well, I know how important it is for me that my Gatorade bottle is aerodynamic. You know, when I toss it to my buddy, "Here, have a swig from my Gatorade." Yeah, I want that to be aerodynamic. I want it to fly through the air really well. I want it to be easy to grab. Come on. I don't think anybody really cares about an aerodynamic bottle. They're worried about what's in it. What is in it? So, anyways, be careful. Be careful of shrinkflation, all right? So the odd thing is about this, that sometimes it costs companies a lot of cash to actually make this happen. If you're going to make new packaging, you need new machines to make it. You got to spend sometimes millions of dollars on the design, the supply chain, to make that package even a little bit smaller. So, hey, if inflation goes down, everything goes back to normal, you've totally wasted your money, you know, unless you're going to stick with the smaller packaging. Anyway, so it's just something that we often don't realize. And if we're not really keeping a sharp eye on the product, how many ounces, how much it weighs, how much is in there, we can easily be hoodwinked. So I don't want that to happen to you. I do not want that to happen to you. Here's one that I thought was really funny, by the way. There's a company called Mondelez. If you've never heard of them, I don't blame you, but they are the makers of the chocolate bar, the famous Toblerone chocolate bar. You know, the triangle one with the triangle peaks? Well, they actually got sued in 2017 because they put more space between the peaks, between those triangular peaks of the candy bar. And they actually got sued, and they went back to the old shape. So all is now right in the world of Toblerone. So I don't know. Well, anyways, there's certainly a wide open space between my ears. Tried to fill it with some fun and truth. Be back with you tomorrow with Cale Clark Show. See you later.
Thank you for listening to my daddy.